Hello, everyone. I'm Kevin Weiner, and thanks for tuning in to another podcast of Beyond Everything Radio. And as always, I have a question for you. Why is delaying gratification so difficult, but also so beneficial to our lives? Why do so many of us choose a tiny bit of good now instead of an incomprehensible amount of good later? In today's podcast and post, we continue our series in Romans with another layer in chapter 8, where Paul illuminates a way to think and live that is so much bigger than religion. Join me now as we compare Paul's definition of salvation to that of modern religion, and we ask ourselves why we would ever settle for a personal transaction when we are offered a cosmic transformation. Hello, everybody, and thank you so much for coming back to yet another podcast of Beyond Everything Radio. I am your host. My name is Kevin Weiner, and I want to welcome you whenever and however you found this podcast. You are not here by accident. I truly believe that you are listening because you're supposed to hear this. I do believe this crazy, silly stuff, you know? Folks, thank you for tuning in, especially as we enter our 19th installment of our series in Romans. And there's more to come. We're about halfway through the book. So this is going to take a good part of the year, and it's going to be worth it. I love the fact that this is one of the few series where my open rates and the number of people signing up are going up as the series is going on. Usually the opposite takes place, where the series causes people to unplug, to check out. But you're obviously learning something. You're sharing it with your friends. I'm seeing new people subscribing. I'm seeing new people sign up. I'm getting new questions and thoughts and feedback. And man, I love it. Give me more. Tell me what you think. Has my cheese slid off the cracker? Is this interesting, engaging? I hope it inspires you. I hope it heals you. I hope it brings you to a truly remarkable place. So without any further ado, let's jump into our 19th installment of our series in Rome. It's podcast number 442, and I call it Groanings Beyond Comparison. And so today we're going to consider Paul's statement from the previous section, which was two podcasts ago, because we had our Psalms installment last week. Came out of chapter 8, which is what we're in the previous paragraph, verse 17, where he said, with the contingency plan, provided we suffer with him in order that we may also be glorified with him. Okay, so this is a continuation of the work that we've been doing. Now, if you remember, we did all of chapter 7 in one post. In chapter 8, I think this is our fourth one in chapter 8, and there's still going to be one more. And why is that? I mean, chapter 8 is packed and stacked. He is building a logic, a case, a new way to live. This is something really, really important, okay? And Paul uses a very specific word for suffering, sumpasko, which means to join in, to share in suffering, to suffer with, right? So Paul is saying we are going to suffer with Christ. Paul, kind of hard to do. It's 2,000 years later, right? I mean, how am I to suffer with him? His suffering predated me by millennia. So obviously, this is a mental framework. He is trying to illuminate how our lives mirror that of Christ's. Now, I hear a lot of people in the Christian faith say, I just want to know God better. I just want to know Jesus. I want to know Christ. And then suffering occurs, and they say, I don't want to know suffering. I want to know Christ. But you see, when you suffer, you are actually having a Christ experience because he suffered. This is the logic. This is how it works in Paul's framework. It's an identification. It's an ability to see Christ's life played out within your life and my life. We are all living this, right? We follow in this Christoform pattern of decline and humiliation, ultimately death, and then this renewal, this new life, right? And since our lives mirror his suffering, this is Paul's case that he's building in this chapter 8. And since we can see Christ's suffering in our life, in our suffering, so our lives are going to mirror this renewal side as well. And he went in to say that we're going to share in his inheritance. Now, this is a way of thinking. Remember, all the way back to chapter 4, this word logizomai, where some traditions only interpret that as counting in a juridical framework. But I see it as a thinking game. Logizomai. It's where we get our word logic. It's a holding a view. It's a perspective. It is, you know, a way of seeing things. It's a way of thinking. And he calls this Christ following. And why wouldn't he? He, Paul, just like you and I, was not a contemporary of Jesus. Like, he was a contemporary of Jesus, but he didn't see Jesus, didn't talk to Jesus. He wasn't like, didn't shake hands with him, you know, eat with him, any of that. He was a virtual disciple, just like you and me. And so he is aligning the life of Christ with his life, and he's following after that because the Spirit is within him, just like it is with you. This is what I call faithing, or faith in Christ. And this is why he used Abraham as this pillar, this apex, this key figure in history as the one that takes us to God. Why? By faith, not religion. Remember, it can't be religion if Abraham is the father of faith. Abraham was not a Christian. Christianity did not exist. Abraham was not a Jew. Judaism did not exist. Abraham predated the Jewish law by hundreds of years. Abraham was a guy who had faith that this other thing was calling him away from his family, away from his safety, away from his security, into a land he did not know. And he went and trusted that voice, and that's why he's the one of faith. And so now Paul is trying to bring all this together. And he's going to say, instead of religion, here's how to live and think. This is the thrust of chapter 8 and why it's so stacked. You know, Paul then switches in verse 18 to using a very different word for suffering. He uses pathema, which means to be in pain, to experience strong physical desire, often sexual desire. Did you know? Doesn't that seem interesting? To be in pain or to experience strong physical sexual desire? It doesn't seem like those two definitions should be shared on the same word. And I've actually worked both definitions through this context and both access Paul's thesis here. So employ whichever one you feel most helpful or most comfortable with. But I've never heard a single sermon in my entire life, in seminary, in Bible school, in all the churches and everything I've ever been to, where they used this pathema as this alternate definition of sexual desire. But I will say this, and I'm not going to give you all the details, I'm just going to cue it up for you. I'm going to put the ball on the tee. You're going to have to hit that one home. But I'm going to put a few things down here, and it's really insightful, especially given the cultural context of Rome. So what does verse 18 say? It says, "For I consider," there's that word, logizomai, "that the suffering pathema of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us." And so what Paul is saying is, he's saying, whatever you're going through, it's not even, it doesn't compare to the glory of what's coming. Like, it's too easy to read these words and have them just wash over us and not really get us to the place where he's actually talking about. We so undercut the value and the bigness of this. It's one of my big pet peeves about the church and about most modern preaching, is it's such an under-hoper. It's an under-teacher. When Paul says it's not worth consider, it's like it's not worth comparing, he's saying, man, what's going to happen? Hold on. Hold my beer. Like, this is a massive thing. And I think it's also important to talk about right now how Paul's distinction from verse 9, where he said, anyone who does, or these not having the Spirit of Christ does not belong to him. Right now, by now, you should be well over this temptation to have innies and outies. Okay, I have been explaining this since day one. If this is your first time listening, this might trip you up a little bit. But this all goes back to Paul's thesis and what we call the Christological continuum of where everybody is in, right? All have sinned and all are justified. Okay, that is so clear to Paul and so built out. But there's also saying that there's a distinction between all of those who are justified, made right with God. Not everybody is actually in the same place. Some people don't belong, right? They haven't put that dowel through their ear to be a slave of love, right? They still feel compulsion to another form of slavery. This is part of the framework. And so Paul's language here is not innies versus outies, even though the distinction exists. It's those who have opened the gift, if you remember my metaphor, that's sitting on your porch, and those that have yet to open the gift. Obviously, the people opening the gifts that come from the governor every single day fall in love with the governor. The people who don't open the gifts don't understand who the governor is and don't care too much about it. That's less of a consideration. But the big point here is that Paul's gospel is that we all start from inside, right? We all start from inside, not from outside. We're not outside, and then we convert to a religion, and then God accepts us. God has already accepted us. We are already justified. It's just, now that we're justified, what are we going to do? Are we going to open the gifts of God that he gives, or are we not going to? Are we going to go our own way, or are we going to go God's way, right? We have these kind of choices to make. And the thrust of Paul's gospel is giving us a new way to live apart from religion. Remember, he is deconstructing religion. He does it in every single book that he has written. Folks, if you're new and that's a shocking idea, the big news of the Bible is that it doesn't put us into a religion. It frees us from all institutional overreach. It frees us from over-identifying with any principality and power. And religion is top among them. See, for Paul, it's a mental framework, logizomai. It's this considering ourselves dead to sin and alive to Christ and God. That's chapter 6, verse 11. This way of thinking, not religion, has now revealed we are adopted as God's children. We're going to inherit all that God has. And even said we're going to co-heir with Christ. This is the glory, the doxa, that awaits us. We will share in Christ's glory, splendor, praise, and honor. Like that, let that sink in. It's almost incomprehensible that our dirty, vile sinnerness is going to share in the glory of Christ. Like, that's kind of putting us on a pedestal there. I don't know they should do that, right? It doesn't seem right. It's right there in black and white. And what Paul is trying to do is to get you to think bigger. He's trying to hook your wench to something so much further than the ditch in front of you. It's literally almost outside of our ability to think. This way of thinking, though, it's going to completely reshape our actions if we pause to consider it. Because it's so big, the temptation is to not ever let it really enter our mind. But what Paul is offering, instead of religion, is saying, let this dominate your mind. Whatever is happening to you now is nothing compared to what is going to happen later when you share in the glory of Christ. He's not making you a god. He's making you a child of God who's going to be an heir, a co-heir, and a receiver. Like, this is really an amazing story of adoption. It's like, oh, you're coming into the family and you're going to be treated like everybody in the family. And nothing in our life compares with what is coming. Nothing you are so upset about, you're so stressed out about, will mean a dang thing in 100 years. I almost guarantee you. Yet alone 1,000. Yet alone in this day of glorification. Like, this is going to be such a nothing burger. And that's Paul's point. This good news has the power to overwrite all the malware scripts. So when you put this thinking, this logizomai, this framework into action for your life, all of a sudden you get out of your small, self-centered little universe where you cannot get over yourself and your pain and your problem. And I'm not trying to minimize it. I know we go through stuff. But by comparison, it's like the tiniest little pimple in the framework of all that that's behind it. The problem is that it's so big and so good, it's too good to be true. We don't believe it. We struggle to believe it. And most churches don't believe this. Most pastors don't preach this. They preach religion. It's much easier. Let's get people scared of hell and get them converted into the religion. And then we can tell them that they have to bring their checkbook every week to pay for my box and my ego. So what does Paul say next? Verse 19, he says, get ready. The creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons and daughters of God. The creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. Holy cow, Paul. So much human suffering. Passion stems from making big things out of small things. It's called idolatry. And Paul is going big here. cosmic, actually. He's reframing our assumption of the cosmos and the future. And while evangelicalism has conveniently taught us that heaven is an earth evacuation strategy, Paul is saying nothing of the sort. He's actually echoing Jesus' words that heaven is coming here. Heaven is in the midst of you. Behold, heaven is here. If I cast out demons by the finger of God, behold, the kingdom of God has come upon you. It's like, hello, heaven's here. It's not a place you go to. See, he's saying the laws of entropy are going to stop. The cosmos, the created world, is waiting for all of us, the sons and daughters of God, to kind of get it together here so that it can be set free from its futility, the mateatos, which means emptiness, its uselessness, its futility, its this flora, the decay, the destruction or corruption, right? It's all entropy. It's all falling apart. It all goes from greater concentration to lesser concentration. It's a breaking down. It's not evolving into this new thing. It's eroding. It's decaying. And the creation is waiting on you and me. Why is it waiting? Well, because Paul is going to say it's waiting on us because we are the eparxē, which means first fruits. We're the foretaste. We're the first ones. In other words, we get our new bodies that don't decay and die, and then we will inherit this world, heaven on earth, that eventually will not decay and die. So the narrative is not you die and you close your eyes and you are in some otherworldly thing, or that God hates this world, is condemning it and destroying it, and it's going to all die and burn and only come back and take Christians up to heaven. Like, that's not the biblical narrative here. This is, you're going to close your eyes, you're going to wake up in this world, but it will be fully renewed. You're going to have that other side, just like Christ, like he said, if you suffer with him, you will also be renewed with him. And so when you do die, because you will, when you wake up, you will be in a new body, but yourself, your perfect body, the one like Christ had that doesn't decay. And you will be in a world that doesn't decay. See, you see this? Like his framework is not evangelicalism's get out of hell framework. Verse 23. Not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for the adoption as sons and daughters and the redemption of our bodies. Now, if you get the big eternal cosmic framework, then the gospel starts to make some sense. Like, the way this framework works is like we're probably all going to die and not see the fully redeemed version of the world. But that doesn't mean that we're not contributing to it. We're in the middle of the play, not the end of the play. And so when we die, it's okay, but we're going to wake up and be in the conclusion when every tear is wiped away, every sad thing has been made untrue. And I'm going to drop a grenade in your mind right now. And when it blows up, you can call me and we'll discuss it. You ready? Why would Paul say that our sexual passions and sufferings are no comparison to the glory of this new world which is coming? Is it because something so much better than sex is awaiting us? Certainly. Yes. But that can't be all. What if Paul is describing an incorruptible suffering or sexual passion awaiting for us in a world that cannot be corrupted, where everything is redeemed, where no one is married, and everyone is in love? If we all are to share in Christ's glory, then what it means is that we are each loved, venerated, glorified by one another, because we see Christ in you, in me, in all of us. We celebrate the Christness that has made us all into this perfect, redeemed place. We are sharing in the mutual, self-giving dynamism of God and Christ and the Spirit. We have entered essentially the Trinity, the Trinitarian flow. This is the picture. This is why Paul uses that word for passion. We're going to know God, and God will know us. Now, think of John 17. This is Jesus' high priestly prayer. And he's praying for his disciples, and then he looks down the corridor of time, and he says, not just them, but everyone who comes after him. So he's looking into your eyes and mine. And he says, I pray that they may all be one, just as you, Father, are in me, and I in you, that they also may be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. This is that mutual self-giving dynamism of God and Christ. Now, if that doesn't make sense to you, your pastor has probably failed you. I hate to say that. But this self-givingness of this Trinitarian flow means that if you were to try and go to God, wherever God is, when you got there, there would be no God, because God would be completely divested of himself into the Spirit. There'd be no God left, because it's entirely in the Spirit. And when you went to find the Spirit, you would notice that the Spirit is not even there, because the Spirit has completely divested itself into Christ. And if you went to Christ, you'd find that Christ is not there, because Christ has fully given himself unto God. And so in this, it's like you could never really get to any one thing, because each is constantly in a dynamic, perpetual flow, giving themselves away to each other. And Christ is inviting us in his prayer into that. And this is what that term means. And this is why he's saying, he's giving us a glimpse of what this is all about. This is why it's like, literally, it's not worth comparing. You get it? Religion sells us salvation as a commodity. Each religion has its own version, and they're all pretty much the same thing. You take it off the shelf, you put your wrapping on it, you put your ritual around it. But in essentially, you're going to buy its commodity, which is salvation. And you're going to buy it with your money and your time and your belief and your loyalty. Each salvation little product is a way for us to escape our lives, escape the terribleness of living, and find another life after we die. And the word soizo, heal, rescue, for salvation here, is a far more benign term than how it's been wielded in religion. And so Paul says we are saved in this hope of this big thing, a dynamic, loving union with God in Christ. That's what saves you. And the way that it saves you is you're considering it, and you're experiencing it. And you're experiencing it because God is flowing through you, in you, now, today. It's not like, you see, Paul's salvation is not a transactional product of religion. Remember, he's been deconstructing religion. It says a transformational flow of faith and experience. Evangelicalism's salvation is praying to invite Jesus into that little door in your heart, and then presto changeo, it saves us by converting us to the Christian religion, which is the only right one. Everyone else is wrong. And Paul's salvation is none of that. Salvation, healing, or rescue for Paul is ontological. It's about your being. Romans has taught us that we all start out justified. We all start out made right with God. Not outside, but inside, not because of our religion. That's the lie of religion. If you get into the religion, then God likes you. If you're out of the religion, then you're out and God can't like you and you have to suffer in hell and die. His brutal punishment. It's come to the marriage bed at gunpoint. It's all it's got. But Paul's gospel is different. Because of what Christ has done, we're in. Not because of what we were done. See, we're given each day a denarius or this Amazon box on our porch. It's manna, however you want to phrase it. And each day it reveals and integrates us into God, into ourselves, into each other, into our world. If we follow our flesh, we foolishly venture from our safe dwelling, seeking what we already possess in an unopened box on the porch. Religion offers individual transaction salvation. But Paul's gospel and the biblical gospel is not just individual transaction salvation. It's transformational salvation for each of our lives, yes, but also corporately for all of our society and our world. And more, it's for the cosmos itself. So an ecological concern like global warming is a humanitarian concern. See that? Paul's not stopping with you. He's not stopping with just society. He's not just stopping with the world, the whole thing. Every sad thing becomes untrue. See, the last nugget here that I'm going to mention before closing is all this groaning. See, Paul tells us that creation, ourselves, and the Spirit are the three things that are all groaning here. Creation, sustenazo, groans together in verse 22, while we, stenazo, groan and complain strongly. So like the world, the cosmos, see, the creation and us, we're groaning in complaint. But then it says the Spirit, stenagmos, sighs with deep concern. That's not a complaint. That's a different kind of groan. It's a groan that comes from Christ interceding, praying for us to God. God, Christ is so divested into God, and he's taking us with him in this sigh of deep concern. What does this mean? Well, the shaft of light that I observe here is that to the degree that we in our created world suffer and groan and complain about our suffering, to the same degree, the Spirit is interceding, praying for us with a commensurate groan of concern and love. Oh my gosh, that blows my mind. I hope that this slower rhythm to dive deep into these passages is helping you. The Greek is so powerful in this framework. And the good news just keeps coming. Paul has shown us a way to live, a pattern of thinking, a change of perspective, that by opening or exploring it, we will not only rescue ourselves from ourselves and our pernicious appetites. Remember, all your appetites are not good gauges. They're not trustworthy guides. Your gut doesn't necessarily lead you in all the right places. But we will also save our societies in ways governments and militaries can't do. And beyond that, we're going to heal every particle of our universe rather than evacuate it. You see, salvation is not conversion. It's completion, because we start from the inside. Just like Paul. Paul was completed. He wasn't converted to anything on the road to Damascus. There was no Christian religion for him to convert to. He was completed into a Christ follower. See, salvation is the mindset that orders our affections for today, not conversion to a religion that saves us after we die. Do you see that difference? God's kingdom of heaven comes to us by coming through us. You want more heaven on earth? You bring it. It's not hard to figure out why religion teaches a gospel other than Paul's, right? You get that, right? The only argument against what I'm saying comes from those making their living by religion. And I know that many of you get upset when I start talking like this. And I know that it kind of rubs you the wrong way, but I invite you, just as in politics, follow the money with religion. You'll find the answer. You'll find that that little part of you that kind of suspected something didn't quite smell right, you're going to discover why it didn't smell right. You see, the gospel here is going to completely subvert religion's ability to cash your paychecks, because he's giving you a way to live that says you don't need all of that. And the only people that are going to argue that you absolutely need all of that are the people who are getting paid to promote it, propagandists. And of course, we become addicted to it. We feel like, well, we get so much out of it, and I like the music. Folks, when we accept the constraints of religion, when you say, I accept it, I trust it, I think it is the best, and because I've picked the best one, now I'm the best. And, you know, even though it requires a lot of me, it takes so much of my time, my money, my effort, and I have to give up my weekends and some midweeks and everything else, I am going to settle for a gospel that is too small, because in all of my life, I didn't have a pastor talking about a cosmic redemption. I had a earth evacuation strategy. And what about you? Does your pastor and your church hate the world, condemn it, see it as skidding off into the wide road of destruction? And therefore you have to pray that someday this rapture occurs and zaps you out of this place? Or is God putting you into your life to redeem it, to redeem everything from the inside out? You see, this is the crux of it. And you know, maybe my cheese slid off the cracker. If you think it is, please, I want you to write me and you show me where I'm wrong, please. I invite you. And if I'm wrong, I will come back on the air and can tell everybody how wrong I was. I have no skin in this game other than to truly teach you the best that I can. And this is what it's saying. Paul's apostolic ministry was to free people from religion, not start a new one. Why? Because he was freed from his religion. He was the epitome of the most Jewish Jew, schooled in the law, the most severe and strict obedient man. And it was broken, destroyed, so that he could take on this other thing, Christ following, which is what I talk about in every podcast. And I know that it's hard to turn loose of your pet, but he didn't have a ministry that was going to start a new religion. He didn't. And now we can see there is no comparison. And that is what this is all about. Until we break all these pieces down, we don't understand what he's saying. The sufferings of this day are not worth comparing to what is coming. That is an amazing gospel. That is good news. And that is what Paul has been given us. God bless you as you contemplate these things.